Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 35, Industrial Weaving. This episode, we talk about the weaving industry. Our guest is weaver and textile engineer Tom Badeau, who grew up in a New England mill town and has had a long and interesting career in textiles. I talk a little bit about the holidays, and finally, we end things up with some weaving resolutions. Before we begin, I'd like to say Happy New Year. I hope your holidays were as fun as mine. In the last week of December, I traveled to Birmingham, Alabama to visit my aunt. Now, my aunt's house is where the Mitchell side of the family all congregates during the holidays. And because I live about 3,500 miles away, it has been a long time since I've been back there. In fact, I haven't been to my aunt's house during the holidays since I was a teenager. So we're talking decades. It's a long, expensive trip, but Kai had a whole crop of second cousins that are about his age who he had never met. There was my aunt and my uncle and my two cousins and their spouses and five grandchildren. And then there was Kai. So there were six small children running around. My dad and his lady friend showed up. There were my teenage twin brothers, my older brother, and me and Eric, of course. So it was a very, very full house. My dad's girlfriend, Sue, said that Aunt Marilyn was a very brave woman to host us all. In true Southern hospitality, I think she only stopped cooking long enough to sleep. The woman was always in the kitchen. But it was a great time. We had a lot of fun. With that many children and teenage boys in the house, and we had a lot of fun things. There was generally a soccer game going on outside. Because, even though this was December, this was Alabama, 72 degrees. Yes, those of us in the northern climes, we can eat our hearts out. All kinds of fun things happened. We even had what I call an Alabama snow fight. It started out with this little pop gun that shoots marshmallows and just suddenly degenerated into all of us throwing large marshmallows at each other. That was my Alabama snowball fight. It was an amazing time. The thing about family is, no matter how long you've been away, when you go back, it's like you never left. All the love, all the stories, all the rivalries, they're all right there waiting for you to pick up. And there's something special about spending time with the folks who knew what you were like as a child. I think it's kind of fun, too, for them to see how you've turned out. This episode was originally scheduled as the December episode, and I apologize that it's coming out a few days late. I had taken the files to edit while I was in Birmingham, and I put them on my husband's laptop, and they would not open properly. So 5 days of editing time gone. Ah, well, I had more time to chase cousins around. You can think of this episode as the memories of holidays just past. And speaking of Alabama, there is a new Weavers Guild trying to get off the ground in Selma, Alabama. If you're interested in being part of a Weavers Guild and you live in Alabama, you can contact Nancy C. I will have a link to her blog in the show notes. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn, a team of two artisan dyers who work in luxury fibers and create amazing colors and hand-painted yarns for knitters and weavers. You can find a selection of their yarns online, as well as information about which shows they're attending. I'm hoping they'll be at Madrona this year. Their booth is dangerous to my budget, so I have to be careful about going in there. But Madrona happens right around the time of both Valentine's Day and my birthday. So usually I have a few gifts coming. Speaking of Madrona, I'll be teaching two classes this year. A beginning weaving class for the rigid head loom that I call the Stash Busting Scarf. In this class, all the students bring their leftover yarn and we make a big pile in the center. And then we pull from that to build a mixed warp. It's a lot of fun. And I also am teaching a class about lace and pickup patterns on the rigid head loom. So if you're going to Madrona or you're just going to be in Tacoma, Washington this February, please swing by and say howdy. I should be pretty easy to spot. I'll either be holding a microphone or wearing a Weavecast t-shirt. Either way, I'd love to say howdy. I've got an update on the Weavecast ensemble. This is really exciting. Several people have gotten in touch, and we've got the beginnings of a great team started. Some of the folks have industry experience, even. How exciting is that? And others are like me, enthusiastic amateurs, and I'm really looking forward to having more voices and perspectives building the show. One of the things that's come out of the ensemble is I've been writing up notes about my audio editing practices and philosophies. And it's really interesting. I've been doing this for 3 years, but I've never before had to explain what I do. And that process of having to understand it well enough to tell somebody else what I'm doing has taught me a lot. I'm having to examine what I do and why. It's that old truism, you don't really understand a subject until you can teach it. We're starting an online group to discuss audio editing in the upcoming shows. If you'd like to help out, join the ensemble, please contact me at sign@weavecast.com. Coming up, we've got an interview with Tom Baudet. He lives in New England and has been involved with the textile industry nearly his whole life. Now, I've never worked in the textile industry. I've never even taken a mill tour. So all I had to go on were the descriptions of life around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And before I talked to Tom, I had the impression that industrial weaving was this dark, dangerous, joyless thing that happened. And I imagined the people who worked in the mill as oppressed masses, just churning through day after endless day. But talking to Tom really opened my eyes, and what he had to say surprised me.
I'm Tom Baudet. I reside in Westfield, Massachusetts, where I have my home, studio, and shop. I came about growing up in a little textile mill town in the early part of the Depression. My dad fired the boilers on the railroad for the locomotives and got laid off and ended up landing a job with a silk mill in Putnam, Connecticut. That's how I ended up growing up in a mill town. The little mill villages were shoulder to shoulder, all up and down the Quinebaug River and the French River, because what was required was moving water to move the water wheels, which is what the power came from. So every spot along any kind of flowing river, even a stream in New England, was captured and a water wheel put in and a mill built. Putnam, where I grew up, there were probably anywhere from 24 to 36 mills of various size, most of which it went anywhere from 50 people to, say, 250 people. But scattered in there, there would be one town that was built around one fairly large mill. 5 miles up the river from where I grew up was North Gromadale, Connecticut, where my wife grew up. And there was one mill there, and that was Cluett Peabody, famous for making arrow shirts. That mill employed about 2,000 people. That one mill was the whole town. You went from one town right into the next little village or town, and those towns were lined up along the rivers, starting from where they emptied into the ocean all the way up to their source, usually in the southern parts of New Hampshire or Vermont. In Putnam, where we had a couple of 36 mills, we had silk mills, we had woolen mills, we had cotton mills, synthetic mills, the whole line. It was a community type affair. Everybody was either your family or extended family, because the size of the mills being so small, you got to know everybody. And the towns being so small, you got to know everybody. Everything was governed by the activity in the mill. The businesses depended on the activity in the mill. If the mills were running good, business was good. Everybody had a little bit of change to share in their pocket. But when the mills went into their slow periods, and that happened every year, then everybody just tightened their belt. It was a way of life. There wasn't a whole lot of money around, especially at the end of the Depression. But everybody got by one way or another, and people kind of looked out for one another. It was a community effort, and it was a good way of life. When I started in the mills, they hadn't changed much for probably 100 years. The equipment had changed some. It had gotten more modernized. but there was no air conditioning or any of that later stuff that came in. But it was tolerable. It was warm in the summer and cooler in the winter, but the conditions were not, depending on what job you had in the mill, now, different jobs in different departments were drastically different. The weave rooms were, for the most part, the physically harder jobs because of the size of the equipment, especially in the woolen mills. The looms were big, the equipment was heavy, and so in addition to it being a technically orientated job, it was a physical job, and for the most part, it was men that held those jobs. But then you went from there to the inspection department where the builders and sewers were. It was all ladies, and they would have their break at noon time, and that's when, for the most part, all of the family functions usually took place. You'd have birthday parties, baptisms, and weddings, and all kinds of things took place during the break times of the mill. It was a family type affair. Growing up in a town like that, you got familiar with the inside and outside of a mill as you were going to school. It was common for kids to bring their parents lunch in and out of the mill. In fact, a lot of kids, for a shortcut to school, you'd walk in the front door of the mill and out the back door so you didn't have to go around the block and wave to people going through. Everybody knew everybody. My brother was 7 years older than I was. And when he came out of the service in 45 or 46, took a job in a weaving mill from a fellow that he knew he was weaving on a couple of St. Kay looms. And one summer they needed a quill winder to make filling for the looms. So he volunteered me for the job, which I thought was great. So I went in during one school summer and learned to run a jack spool winder making quills for the six looms that were running there. Each weaver had two looms. There were three weavers. And it was a family affair as usual. I think the fellow's mother and sister were there in the were the sewer and the burler, and he had an uncle that was the loom fixer, and my brother and two of his friends were weavers, and I was making the filling. Quality control. If I made a soft bobbin, they threw it at me. That was their way of telling me to straighten out, kid. So if a bobbin come flying by me, I knew it was because it was not good. So you paid attention to how much weight you had on the paddles on the jack spools as they were winding down and things like that. So that was my first experience with a mill, a job, and quality control.
Some of the industrial terms Tom mentioned were new to me, so I asked him to explain burler and sewer.
When the cloth comes off the loom, known as the breakcloth, in French it's brigé. In the States, of course, that automatically became gray goods, meaning cloth being made up to the loom. When you take it off the loom before finishing, the cloth comes off the loom, but before it goes to the finishing department, it'll go through the burlers and sewers. It'll go over what we call a perch, where the cloth is inspected by these inspectors, mostly ladies. And they will mark up any defect that they want, a knot or end out or whatever. And then from there, depending on whether the fabric actually has to be re-sewn or can go on to finishing, it's scheduled. So if it goes to the sewers, the sewers actually reweave the defects in the cloth before it goes to finishing. The burler is the one that actually does the inspecting on the perch, and in most cases, if it's fabric that goes into wearing apparel, they'll push knots or any slubs or anything like that to the back, because that's what's going to go against the lining of the fabric and away from the surface. And if it's just that, then it gets burled and on to finishing. But if it needs to be repaired, it'll go to the sewers, where the sewers actually reweave the fabric before it goes to the finishing. It's very highly skilled work, especially the sewers. It takes a long time for that expertise to be developed. In those days, the jobs in the mills were pretty much identified as the higher skilled or lower skilled. And those people in the higher skilled jobs, there was always those that were star performers and those that were just run-of-the-mill performers. The stars were known throughout the community. They were held in esteem like ball players. Everybody knew them as the best. They had a kind of a prestige around town where everybody knew who they were. It was interesting. Most of the mills were fully integrated. They started out with raw fiber and then ended up shipping either finished or woven cloth out the door. They did every process in between. The mill that I'm most familiar with in my pre-college days was in the woolen mill where the fiber came in, raw bales of wool, and it was scoured and then sorted and put into different bales. And that was all done in a warehouse in what we call the picker house. The picker house is where the first opening of the blends came. That's where the blends were made. The blends were laid out for the different colors, different yarns that went into the different fabrics. They were prepared for the card room. They went through the picking and the pre-blending. All of those required a job in the picker house, the head picker or the baler or jobs of that type. And then it went to the card room where the fiber was carded out into roving. If it was a worsted mill, it went from the cards to the combs, either the French comb or noble combs, and then to the drafting frames, double then draft, and into spinning. Or if it was a woolen mill, it went directly from the cards onto the spinning frames. In the card room, you had the card tenders, the card strippers, and a number of jobs in between where they carried bales and things of that type. But the primary jobs were the carder. He tended the cards and saw to it that the roving coming off the cards was of the right size to go to the spinning room. And when it got to the spinning room, then went on to the frames. And we had the spinners, we had the doffers, and we had the frame cleaners, you had the floor people. From there, it went to the weave room, either in the form of going to the bobbin winders for filling or to the warping frames for warps. If it was in a woolen mill, it usually went to a pin or a pinless reel. It had all kinds of support equipment on it, the compressor rolls and so forth to make the warp beams, because the beams in an industrial mill were full width with flanges on each end, and they were warped to the density that you could actually walk on them and not damage the yarn. They were that hard, and they had to be in order to support themselves, because the warps that went into most of the looms that I was familiar with, a cut was anywhere from 80 to 90 yards long, and there might be 20 to 30 cuts on one beam. Woolen mills were on the low side as far as numbers of cuts on a beam. But when you get into the finer synthetics and the silk bills and so forth, they would put thousands of yards onto a beam. It would run, and as the cut marks came up, the cuts were doffed. And then when the warp ran out, it was replaced with another one, and it started all over again. Most hand weavers will buy 5 or 6 pounds of yarn to make a particular scarf or a table runner or whatever. For the most part in the mill, we couldn't lay a blend of less than 300 pounds, it would take that much just to fill the card wire. So you're talking lots of yarn of 500 pounds or up for the most part, anywhere up to 10,000 pounds to a lot. And this was all done in the expertise of blending in the blending room, which is where all of the skills in each of these departments centered on certain people in certain positions being very highly skilled. Because the matching of the shades and the size of the yarn and everything, that had to be precise. It grew in those days more out of experience than it did scientific development. We had scales that would weigh the roving and tell you how close you were. But, of course, they didn't have the equipment or the scientific approach that we had in the mills when I retired. I mean, it was night and day. The bottom line was it was an artistic approach as far as the manufacture of fabric was concerned. It's a fiber art, and that's all there is to it. No matter how scientific you can get, and we could get, when I was with the Albany Felt Company, designing and manufacturing papermakers' felts, it was probably the highest scientific approach required of a fabric. And we had lots of very highly refined equipment to keep it within certain parameters. But at the same time, when you were fulling wet felt to a certain weight and width and length, it was an art. It decided how long it had to be fulled and when to take it out of the fulling mill.
Tom had talked about his childhood in a mill town, but I wanted to hear more about how he got started in industry.
I started out growing up in a mill town, hearing the mill whistles, the steam whistles from the locomotives going through, and all was as common as breathing the air. Everybody in the town was mill bred. A lot of kids in my high school class wanted no part of the mills. They chose to go to Hartford, to the big Pratt & Whitney aircraft plants, or to New London, to the sub base. But I liked the mill. I can remember the first time I walked through the yard at Putnam Woolen, my first job in a woolen mill. I walked through the yard and smelled the wet wool, and I said I'd found NECA. This was it. I was just ecstatic that I was there. It made me feel like I was finally in the big league, that I was working in the mill, getting paid for it. Because in those days, you didn't get paid to learn the job. If you wanted to stay, you learned it quick and learned it right, or you were gone fast. It was tough love. People would look out for one another as if they were blood family. They would watch one another's back all the time. But as far as learning was concerned, you were expected to be very receptive to direction, very receptive to learning. And if you didn't have the right attitude, you went to school, went to high school. During high school, had the part-time jobs in the mill after school. And then after high school, I graduated. I went full-time in the mill. And then when it came time, I was drafted, went into the Army. When I come back out of the Army, I went back into the mill and decided then that if I was going to stay in the mill, I really should go get more education because I wanted to be like that superintendent that walked through every day. To me, he had made it. He was God. I'd see the superintendent walk through the mill every day, and he had respect. He had a dignity about him. I said, that's what I want. I decided I'd better go to school, so I applied at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, textile engineering degree, started days in a degree program in 1954, and when I did, I started weaving nights in different mills, all up and along the rivers, kept living in Putnam. I drove to Providence every morning to go to school, which was 26 miles, went to school from 8 to 4, and then left school at 4 o'clock and drove to Dudley, Massachusetts, where I was weaving nights in a linen upholstery mill. And then we'd get out at midnight, and I'd drive back to Putnam again, which was back into Connecticut. So I went from Connecticut to Rhode Island to Massachusetts, back together. Putnam was right up in the corner of the states. All three states come together pretty short space. After the first child came in 1956, I was in my third year of college. I'd get home at night, and he happened to be a colic baby. So I'd fall asleep in a chair with him laying on my belly, belly to belly, because that's the only way he could sleep. So I'd wake up in the morning and get up and go back all over again. It was tough, but we didn't realize it was tough. We did what we wanted to do. We had focused on goals, and we just went and did them. The last 2 years of college was a little bit easier because I'd gotten to become quite friendly with the design professor at school. And he was nightlighting at a worsted mill in Pasco, Rhode Island, and he was laying out the pattern blankets for him. He needed a guy to do the hand weaving for the pattern blankets, so he would lay the blankets out, and I would weave them on the hand looms at college during our labs. Then at night, I'd go into the mill and dress the warps and weave them on the power looms. Then when they sent the samples to New York and got the colors and patterns picked out that they wanted, out of the blanket, they would order 3 and 4 cuts of each of the samples, and I would lay out and dress and warp the samples and weave them for them into salesman's samples to send back to them to make up their books with. That was a little easier than weaving in a linen mill the first 2 years. Weaving in a linen mill is a tough job.
What is it about weaving linen that makes it so tough?
The yarn itself was not as finely spun, and it had a lot of cellulosic debris still in it. So it got hung up in the drop wires on the looms, and an end went down. Instead of the drop wires dropping and stopping the loom would keep running. The first thing you know, you had an end out for about 5 or 6 or 7 inches. You shut the loom down and pick it out, and picking it out, the second hand or the boss, you did not like looms stopping because of that, and so you were not, for the moment, held in very high esteem. Because they usually have to take 2 or 3 people off the floor to come help you pick it out. It was tough. When I graduated, I got hired by Millikan in their woolen division. They had 9 mills in their woolen division, 3 of them in Maine and the rest in North and South Carolina. But they sent me up to Maine because of my background in weaving and so forth. When I finished the familiarization program of the makeup of that particular mill, they offered me the overseer weaving job because of my weaving background and having 10 years experience already in the mill before I ever graduated from college. They made me the overseer weaving in a fancy woolen mill, which to me was fantastic. three shifts, running 24 hours a day, 6 days a week on fancy goods, women's wear and men's wear, and it was right down my alley. Then from there, I got transferred, promotion, and in those days, you didn't have to have an evaluation every 6 months to find out how you were doing. If you got transferred to another mill within your division or even into another division with a promotion, and you didn't need an interview to tell you you're doing pretty good because they didn't move people up that weren't. When I got promoted to a job in the Hatch Mill in North Carolina as an assistant superintendent, part of the assistant superintendent's responsibility was selecting all the wools for that particular mill that went into the various seasons blends, and so I spent a lot of time in Boston at the wool buying office and becoming familiar with the wools in all shapes and forms. And that was all part of the job.
After working in a woolen mill producing garment cloth, Tom was hired as a design engineer for a mill that produces felts for papermaking machines. Now, if you've ever made paper by hand, you know that felts are inserted between the wet sheets of paper during compression. They both help take water out of the paper and also prevent the wet sheets of paper from sticking to each other. Now, in industry, it's a bit more complicated. Instead of having individual sheets of felt that are pressed like a giant sandwich, the felts in industry are these enormous loops of fabric that, in addition to helping remove the water and compressing the paper, drive the machinery. In a paper mill, a wire refers to a fabric belt that can be hundreds of inches wide.
I was hired by Albany Felt Company as a design engineer. Papermaker's felts. They're probably the highest engineered fabric woven in the mills. Very technical product. These paper machines are huge. I had the newsprint and craft group, and they were the biggest machines in the world. Some of them were three stories high and about a block long. The pickup section coming off the Fourdrinier wire, there was one roll that drove the entire system. That roll and on that pickup position, the jack was probably at best 6 inches long. So you had to design a felt 120 feet long, endless, and most of the felts that I designed were endless felts, 300 or 400 inches wide. You had to come to tension on that 6-inch jack, or you wouldn't drive the machine. The tension required was very highly scrutinized because you had to design it so that they could get it on the machine to begin with, which is a task in itself. And then when they got it on and spread it out, they had to bring it up to tension, and they had to get their tension in that 6 inches of jack. So it was very, very critical. If you managed to do that, which we had to do or we weren't in business very long, then the second thing, of course, was the surface had to be absolutely defect-free because any defect on the surface of that felt would show up in the paper in a watermark of some kind. And if that was the case, it would cut the felt off. So when I first went with Albany Felt Company, about 50% of the felts that were just straight out woven and felted and then brushed and singed and treated in one way or another so that you had a very smooth woven fabric. But then later on, in addition to the woven base, they started developing the needle punch system, which I was in on the ground floor on, and the introduction of some of the synthetics. Up until that time, most all of the felts were 100% wool. Because wool, of all the natural fibers, and in fact even synthetic fibers, wool has the best compaction and recovery characteristic of any fiber known. The compression between the nip rolls on the machines, it was critical for the life of the felt that that fiber be compacted and then recover so that the felt would drain the water, which was the third most important part of the felt itself. It had to drive the entire power transmission belt to drive the entire unit to begin with. And secondly, it had to provide a finish on the paper that was defect-free. And third, it had to be the best drainage possible because the more water you drain, the faster you could run the machine. Paper companies would spend millions of dollars building one machine. Once they started it, it ran 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. They didn't want to shut it down. Now, you got to realize that most paper furnishes are anywhere from 91 to 93% water. There's only 8 to 9% actual solids in that furnish to begin with. So once you pour it onto the four-drainage wire, you've got to get rid of 90% of the content of it as fast as you can. So the only thing you're left with is the fibers, which is the makeup of the paper itself. Cotton rags or cotton linters, whatever you're making the paper out of, that's what you want left. In that mill, which was one of the leaders in the industry, still is, you had all of the latest equipment at your disposal. As a designer, you were pretty much king of the hill. You didn't work alone. You worked in teams. You had a lot of support. You had a lot of people looking at you from the top. You had a lot of people looking at you from below. And you could call on whatever you needed to produce that product. So you got all the scientific help you could get as far as measurements of elongation and recovery of the yarn. You had scientific equipment to evaluate and did a lot of sampling. At Albany Felt, we had a paper machine in the mill itself that ran felts to do the testing on. And they had a lot of history to go by, which is probably the most important thing. We kept immaculate records of every product that went through, exactly what it did in every step of the way, so that we knew where adjustments needed to be made for the next group of felts. Record-keeping was paramount in all industry. In apparel, it probably wasn't to the degree that it was in the papermaker's felts, but it was necessary in all of those areas to some degree. If the product didn't come out either quality-wise or function-wise, we knew where to go back and make adjustments. When I left Albany Felt Company, went with a company by the name of Tetco, which was a Swiss-owned silk weaving operation, had mills throughout Switzerland and France, Germany, and one mill here in the U.S., and I ran that mill. I was general manager of the manufacturing division for Tetco. In this mill, they made silk screen printing media, filtration, and in that filtration program, we got an order to make filters for filtration during open heart surgery. The fabric was made out of 100% Monel wire, was woven in Germany, and woven to an aperture of 5 micron. If you look at a fabric of 5 micron, it looks like a plastic sheet. You can't see the interlacing. And it had to be precisely 5 micron in order to allow the red and white blood corpuscles to pass through and nothing else. Because while the patient was undergoing the operation, the blood was being circulated through the machine and fed back into their body again, and there could be no outside forces into the system. So they brought it in, and we had to set up a white room to do all the machine stampings. And I'm actually there as the general manager of that division, in addition to all the weaving and the looms and everything else. I also assumed a metal stamping operation and all kinds of other stuff that went with it, which was common. Got involved with the weighing of these. They were so fine, and we had to set up a white room where once they came in, you had to have gowns and gloves and everything else on. The individual filters were so fine, in order to get any kind of weight on them, you had to have stacks of them, and we weighed them with electronic scales that were brought in from Switzerland. And that was one of the most interesting products that I was involved with.
At this point, I started to realize that industrial weaving didn't just refer to the industry of weaving itself, that woven goods actually power other industries.
There is probably more fabric produced for industrial purposes than there is for apparel. Most people don't realize that, but if you go through checkout counters, supermarkets, we made all those belts in Buffalo. That's what we did. We made belt conveyor belts for anywhere from the checkout counters at supermarkets to unloading ocean-going ships that were transporting iron ore or coal or flour or grain, all kinds of materials that needed specific engineered parameters in order to load and unload. Now, you take, for instance, flour. Flour, once it rumbles down the road or gets tossed around in the ship, it settles, and it settles like cement. And in order to unload it, it's almost as hard as cement. It has to be stored on a belt. When you get ready to unload it, you force air through the belt, and the air will lift the flour enough off the belt so the belt can start moving, and you unload it from the bottom up. That's the only way you can get it unloaded. Huge 6, 8, 10, and 12 layer belts depending on how tough the belt had to be in order to move that product. You can just imagine conveying iron ore out of a mine takes a pretty rugged belt, and that's what we made. Fire hose is probably the toughest stuff to weave that there is, because it's wove endless, and it's finished off the loom. In other words, what you take off the loom is what actually is fabricated into the fire hose. So it can leak only to the point where it starts to swell, and then it has to stop leaking. There was a secret in that. It all has a story to it.
I asked Tom what he meant by the term endless woven.
You weave tubular. So I was the first engineer in Albany Felt to start pushing emphatically endless woven belts. Up until that time, the flat woven were taken off the loom and actually joined. We had girls joining. Now, you remember I mentioned the fact that early woolen mills, we had burlers and the sewers would reweave. Well, we had sewers at Albany Felt that would actually take an endless felt anywhere from up to 10,000 ends and actually reweave the ends together to make it endless. And that had to be rewoven to the point where you could not detect the defect or an unevenness at that joint or it would leave a mark. And that's how good they had to be. And they were. It took years and years to develop this department of ladies that had the kind of skill required to actually reweave these felts. And when I came along and started introducing endless felts, I was not held in very high esteem, because it meant that some of these girls would not have a job. And as I said, all of the textile industry is very close-knit, so you watch one another's back. So there was a fine line there that you had to walk. But it was inevitable, because in order to produce the goods that needed to be produced, you had to weave them endless. So that's the way it had to go. That's all there was to it.
After a decades-long career in textiles, what advice would Tom give from his time in the industry?
Keep records on everything. Be very detail-oriented record keeper. Because in hand weaving, most all the hand weavers wear all the hats. You're a one-person operation. You dress the warps, you weave the goods, you take the goods off, you finish the goods, you know, you do the whole nine yards. So in order to take a fabric and duplicate it, which in a lot of cases is what you're going to do, because you never really hit that fabric the way you want to the first time around. It's not likely to happen. So if you keep good records, keep note of everything. We had layouts in the mills that had the history of every single yarn that was made. It was all detailed very closely. And when we talk about a layout in the weave room, we're talking about a layout that has all of the information on it, from the yarns that went into it, the weave that was used, how it was finished, so that when it comes time to duplicate that fabric again, you know exactly what you did and where you can go from there. Now, if a hand weaver does the same thing, you'll find yourself bonding with your equipment so that you know it inside out. And when you do that, it's developing the expertise of your profession. It's fiber art, and that's all there is to it. It's an art. When you develop that art, as a painter or anybody else does, to perfection, even if it's just for your own self-satisfaction, you know you're doing it as good as can be done. And that's the key. There are no mistakes. There are absolutely no mistakes. Everything is a learning process.
And of course, I was curious about what Tom is currently working on.
I've been retired now since 1980. I ventured off into a couple of venture, and that's a good word for it, outside of my background in textiles. But when I finally retired, and this is the third time I've retired, I retired with a little weaving studio. I enjoy what I'm doing, so I have no problem putting in lots of hours at it. It's what keeps me challenged. It gives me a reason to get up in the morning. Because that's what retired people need. They need to be motivated so that they have something to look forward to. In my case, I've always enjoyed textiles. In fact, I loved it. I still do. I have young weavers, new people coming in, wanting to learn how to weave and so forth. I impress on them the importance of detail and developing the expertise, whether it's for your own self-satisfaction or if you're going to start a little business selling rugs or whatever. The key is to get good at what you're doing. Nobody's ever going to get rich hand weaving. I don't know of anybody that did. But you developed an enjoyment of what you were doing and we were able to earn an income from it. And I do some weaving of my own these days, mostly to either prove a point for the loom itself, which I'm retrofit. I rebuild looms and I restore looms, and I also sell new looms. I'm a dealer for Loom Clerk. Francis Brassard, the owner of Loom Clerk, and I are very close friends, and I do a lot of consulting work for him, and I do a lot of prototype work for him here in my shop. If I'm prototyping a loom of some type, I'll figure out the toughest fabric that loom would probably ever face in a hand-weaving situation, and I put it on, and I put it through its paces. Well, Simon, it was a pleasure, because I enjoyed talking fiber rod.
It's kind of weird. The economy is tanking, and the news is all doom and gloom about this could be a second depression, but I'm feeling really hopeful about 2009. And I'm excited about New Year's resolutions this year. Right now, 2009 feels like a year that's bright and sparkly and flawless as a new field of snow. And I feel that right now the decisions we make are going to determine the kind of people we're going to be in the coming year. Really, you make this decision day to day, but it's easier to see the horizons in front of you at the beginning of a new year. So, my resolutions? This year, I would like to make health a priority. For too many years, I have cheated my body in terms of exercise and nutrition, and that is not fair. I'm going to complete a tapestry. I think I said this in last year's resolutions, but I'm a little scared to go back and check. So, if I did, I really mean it this year. This year! Maybe even this month. I will complete a tapestry. As God is my witness. This year, I would like to spend more time with family and friends. I live out in the boonies, so it's not always easy to get together with friends. But when I do, it is such a warm and wonderful feeling. And if the economy is tanking, I mean, really, hanging out with your friends, it doesn't cost anything. Maybe there is a bright side to our current economic situation. Maybe it will remind us what the really important things are. It was interesting when I was listening to Tom, and he would briefly talk about hard times in the mill town, and he briefly touched on the depression. And people got through it, and people got through it by working together and watching each other's backs. So maybe that's something that's ahead of us in the coming year. And my final resolution, and this is one I make nearly every year, and I keep it every year, but it's worth repeating. Have a little fun every day. This is something my dad advised me to do when I was in graduate school, and I was working insanely hard. He said, no matter how hard you're working, make sure to have a little fun every day. This was a goal worth renewing. So what about you? Do you make New Year's resolutions? If so, what are you planning to work on this year? Do you make weaving resolutions? Personal resolutions? What kind of person do you want to be in 2009? That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped. Because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. I'm going to close you out with a Christmas song. Yes, I know Christmas is technically over, but it's a funny song.
We three kings of Orient are.
All right, mates. One, two, a one, two, three.
Swell the decks with boughs of holly, fa-da-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Hoist the Roger if it's jolly, fa-da-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Don we now our pirate trappings, fa-da-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Caught me peg leg in these wrappings, fa-da-la-la-la-la-la-la-la.
From the port side to the starboard, and from transom to bow, we are covered with invading bivalves. They latched on when we were harbored, and nobody knows how to remove them and get the ship clear.
Barnacles, barnacles, give me a friggin' damn crowbar. Barnacles, barnacles, soon they will eat this whole bay.
said the lookout to the bosun's mate. Do you hear what I hear?
Do you hear what I are?
Oh, cannonball, oh, cannonball, I'll shoot you through the stockade wall. All I want for Christmas is me two front teeth. Me two front teeth. Me two front teeth. All I want for Christmas is me two front teeth. Oh, we don't even have to change that one. My captain told me, pa-rum-pa-pum,
pa-rum,
rum, or rum.
I'm trying to sing you, Squealish Rum.
Fine, fine. You better watch out. You better not cry. Get the rum out. I'm telling you why. Captain Jack is coming to town.
He walks with a list, talks a good game. Blade, kiss, or fist, it's always the same. Captain Jack is coming to town. He seizes any treasure, but rum and wenches too. He knows if you've been bad or good,
and either one will do.
Don't follow his lead, it's gonna get grim. The only survivor likely is him. Captain Jack is coming to town. Christmas, Christmas time is here. Time for loot and wine and beer. Santa, bring your big old bag. We want treasure, we want swag. Want a map from some old book.
Me, I want a brand new hook.
We can hardly stand the wait. Please, Christmas, don't be late. I saw the captain kissing Santa Claus down below the bulwark late last night.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Are the herald angels singing? Here's a letter from the king.
Up in the crow's nest, it's my watch, keeping warm with rum and scotch. Icy winds and freezing sleet, too darn slippery to keep my feet. Yo ho ho, who wouldn't go? No problem.
Silent night, holy night, shush the cat, douse the light. Round the back, the door isn't locked. Grab their stuff, we'll go get it hot. Sleep in heavenly peace. The constable's palms have been greased.
All right, yes, swabs, big finish.
Dashing through the snow is something we ain't done, because we never go away from tropic sun.
Keep your cold and ice.
We think it's kind of dumb.
We've got our Christmas paradise with beaches, girls, and rum.
Arr!
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to sail the Caribbean today. Jingle bells, Christmas on the sea. Yo-ho-ho, yo-ho-ho, a Santa's life for me. Yo-ho-ho, yo-ho-ho, a Santa's life for me.
Merry Christmas, matey.
And a happy new...
Arr!
WeaveCast is made possible through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Patricia, Rachel, Gina, Linda, Kathleen, and Dorothy. Thanks for your support. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn, two lovely ladies who dye luxury fibers to create amazing colors and hand-painted yarns for knitters and weavers. You can find a selection of their yarns online, as well as information about which shows they'll be attending in 2009. For that, go look at www.justouryarn.com. Our musical guest this episode was Tom Smith with A Pirate Christmas.